You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Thank you. I think we wish to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and Huron-Wendat First Nations. Good morning. My name is Jean Hamill, and I'm amazed to see so many people here this morning. There must be a very special guest. You may not be aware of it, but this came on me rather suddenly. I love to do this, you know. But I didn't know it was going to happen this morning. So you got to put up with what you're going to get.
The second announcement is my climate change announcement. So at West Hill, every Sunday, we do something about climate change or the environment. And I usually try to make it, you know, sort of funny and something really practical. This week is a little bit different. Monday was April the 1st, which was April Fool's Day. It was also something else. Anybody know? Yes. Correct. So I'd really like to talk about that this morning. Exhibit A. Here he comes right now. No joke. The federal carbon tax came into effect. Yeah, there it is. Yes. And so those of you on Facebook know that the incredible amount of misinformation and mudslinging, really, that's going on has been quite something. So people have been writing me and asking questions, and I'm not an expert in carbon taxes, but I thought I would do the climate change minute this week on that. And this is where, you know, those of you who know me will know that this is where my extensive background in tax accounting is going to come in handy. Not. So I'm going to do my best, and I've done it as a questionnaire so that you can participate. So the federal carbon tax is now in effect and increases the cost of fossil fuels in order to reduce consumption. So question number one, true or false? The federal carbon tax will raise the price of coal more than the price of natural gas. True or false? It's true. Mm-hmm. The carbon tax is applied to fossil fuels based on how much pollution they create when they're burned. So if coal, for instance, makes more carbon pollution than natural gas, they're going to tax that at a higher rate. And it doesn't apply to hydroelectricity and other energy sources that are green. Number two, true or false? The tax is being applied in only four provinces. As you know, Ontario is one of them, because it was just a lottery system and they're just trying it out on these four provinces. No? Oh. No, false. Yeah. So why is it that we have this and other provinces don't? Anybody? Other provinces are already doing it, yes. And we were too until recently. So now that we are no longer doing anything around carbon, this is being applied to us as well. And the idea was that all of the provinces agreed, other than Saskatchewan, to do this a couple of years ago, and the leadership has changed in a few provinces, and now they are not agreeing to do that, so the federal government is stepping in and imposing carbon tax. Number three, true or false? Residents of other provinces are also paying an equivalent tax. It's true. Yeah, some of them are paying more and have been for years. Number four, how much is this going to cost me? So it's a multiple choice. To fill up a 50-liter tank, mine's 40, so, but I know people have different. So the cost will go up by A, $10, B, $5, C, $2.50 to fill up a 50-liter tank. $2.50. Right? So one of the criticisms is it's actually so low that it's not going to make that much difference. They're trying to ease us in to this. And it'll go up annually to 11 cents a liter. Number five, true or false, the total cost for an individual, let's say Mel, total cost for Mel is going to depend on how much fossil fuel energy that she uses. It's true. Yeah. So if you drive more, or if you drive a bigger vehicle, or if you have a massive house and you're, you know, heating it at high levels with fossil fuels, you're going to pay more tax for that, right? Because you're contributing more to the problem. And those who take public transit or have smaller cars, drive less, they're going to pay less. The idea is that it's encouraging us to find ways to do this differently, right? And the average household cost in Ontario is going to be about $244 for the year in extra carbon taxes. That's what they're predicting. Okay, a couple more. Number six. True or false, the government is going to tax that money and keep it and then reinvest it into clean energy research and technology. True or false? It's false. And that's one of the big things on Facebook is, you know, if you think that money is going to go to green technology, you're being, you know, delusional. So I wrote back and said, I don't think it's going to go into that because they're not keeping it, right? So the idea is they're collecting all that money and they're going to redistribute it back to the households evenly. So the idea is that you'll get a rebate on your tax bill. That's how this is going to work. So we'll talk a little bit more about that in a sec. Number seven, true or false, the size of your rebate depends on your income and on showing receipts to prove how much extra tax you paid. False. Yeah. The rebate is not based on your income, and there are no hoops. It's just being distributed. So if you don't, you know, spend a lot on carbon, you can make some money on this deal, right? The average household in Ontario is going to get back $300, and you're spending on average $244. So the average household is going to make money on this deal. All right. True or false, the government is returning 90% of the taxes and keeping 10% for administration of the program. False. They're returning 90% to households, and the other 10% is going to hospitals and schools and other programs in our communities. So 100% of the money they collect is going back to us. And I think this is my last question. Number nine, true or false, carbon taxes decrease emissions. It's kind of a trick question. The tax itself doesn't decrease emissions, right? However, income tax and sales tax and that sort of thing exist to raise money, right, for the government to pay for services like schools and hospitals. That's the idea. And the environmental tax is different. The idea of the environmental tax is to create a price incentive for consumers to save energy or switch to lower energy. So it's all about using the market forces. And the example they gave, which totally I got, was that, you know, we respond to higher prices. Do you remember when cauliflower went up to $8? How many of you bought cauliflower? Like, I did not. I bought broccoli. So that's the idea here, too. If the money, if the cost goes up, we're going to make different choices. And the good news is that where it's been happening already, the research is showing that this works around the world. Sweden's a great example. BC is another example. So that's your quiz and information on the carbon tax. So at Easter, when you're with your family, you can have a, you know, great conversation about that this year. So I'll leave you with this quote. This is from the former president of India. And his quote was, "Let us sacrifice our today so that our children can have a better tomorrow." Offered as wisdom for the journey, may we walk in its light. Thank you.
How many of you have ever been in an earthquake? How many have been standing in the when the worst? There was an earthquake the day Greta was ordained. That could go either way. We haven't been in an earthquake. We've been in the area that an earthquake came in Christchurch. And when one's foundation shakes, that's a hugely disorienting thing. Because we kind of expect the ground under our feet to be solid. And when it's not, it's almost like nothing we know can we count on. And so when we came here in our community here to ground ourselves in something that we knew was true, no matter what, we chose to ground ourselves in the fact that life is, and life is interconnected. Things can connect and affect each other. I affect you, you affect me. I'm affected by life and hurricanes and earthquakes. No matter what, that's true. But that can be used for ill or for good. If I know I can impact you, I can impact you for my own good and not yours. And so we strive over and over and over, not just weekly, but daily and sometimes hourly and sometimes by the minute, to choose to impact life and to impact each other lovingly, caringly, justly, compassionately. It's always a choice. If you do it enough, it becomes natural, but and then something else comes up and it doesn't feel natural, and we have to choose and choose and choose and share the wisdom of that. And that's how we want to live on the web of life, which I'm going to play in a moment. So just seep yourself in those big, big realities of this amazing thing called life and this amazing choice called love.
Our readings this morning are on empathy, of course. The first one is by Dr. Goldman. Tamara is one of the most empathetic people I know. Almost every day she comes home with heartfelt stories that often make me cry. Empathy is a big part of what she tried to bring to her working relationship with clients. Sometimes I need to put myself in someone's place and not to judge them, she says. Life can change so quickly, and when it does, it has such a snowball effect, with one circumstance leading to another. Everybody's got a story, and I feel honored and privileged to hear people's stories, and that they feel comfortable sharing them with me. Tamara has an uncanny ability to inspire people to confide in her. Her empathy doesn't come from having been disadvantaged herself. Still, when I ask her where she thinks her empathy comes from, she says it comes from knowing what it's like to be told you're not good enough. So I always try to say something positive about them and about their skills and abilities. The second reading is from onekindplanet.org. Empathy is feeling what others feel. Empathy is the ability to not only detect what others feel, but also to experience that emotion yourself. We humans can empathize with each other and other animals. When we empathize, we feel into others and understand how they feel. We do this with people all the time. We also do it with non-human animals. Anyone who has cared for a companion animal, such as a dog, will likely empathize with them too. For example, feeling their excitement at dinner time, boredom after a long day indoors, pain when they stand on a thorn. It is thought that empathy is more likely to be present in social species. Once believed by many to be only a human trait, scientists are now finding evidence of empathy in non-human animals, mainly in other primates, such as chimpanzees, orangutans, but also in dogs, mice, and recently in chickens. Empathetic behavior has also been reported in elephants. offered as wisdom for the journey. May we walk in His light.
The focus moment this morning came out more as a story than as a poem, so I'm going to try to break it up into half sentences so it feels like a poem instead of a story. We sat, uncomfortable in the cramped space, our dispensed paper number still a dozen away from our turn at the desk. A child screamed. Its mother struggled to quiet the noise as the rest of us cast furtive disapproval at one another. 87. A man rose, made his way to the desk. Another took his seat, his own ticket clamped in his little child's fingers, a tattered teddy in the boy's other hand. I shifted in my seat. Why do parents bring their children to these places? The space felt more cramped than ever. And then the boy stirred, slipped from his father's lap, evaded the half-hearted grasp, and set out across the crowded room. We watched him teeter past outstretched legs, around bags, stumble through fallen coats, until he arrived in front of the mother, exhausted by her struggling, unhappy child. The screaming paused while it considered this small interruption in its rage, then filled its lungs for another howl. But the boy, the little boy, reached out and pressed his ragged toy into the child's arms. Eyes met eyes. And we finally understood.
Deb? This is such an old chestnut, and so I hope the tune grounds you into your past and your present, but the words Greta wrote to it move us into the future beautifully, compellingly. Babette's going to sing, and she's going to invite you to join in the last verse of this song. Amazing as the topic is, the song is Love Again. When the first stretched a human heart emerged from deep within, our lives were changed forevermore. That time must come again. For quick as love did fear arise and work to bring love down, it's shame lurk in trouble.
for another moment wanes, may we our love renew and pledge to build up what remains of all that's good and true. For only we can love and care, commit to duty's call. Remember all that's right and fair, and vanquish fear for all.
If you'll stand with me and sing the last verse.
May love emerge forever strong, those bound in fear. Shall end the wrongs, love ever to increase. Amazing, amazing grace.
Anybody else? Thank you, Babette, and thank you, Greta, for those beautiful words. I have the distinct privilege and pleasure of introducing our guest speaker this morning. I know nobody here knew he was coming. And I will share with you some of his online bio and then some informal bio. Sorry, that was so moving to me. I need a cleaner. Many of you will know that we've been studying the power of kindness this fall and winter. And so this is from Brian's online bio. He is a highly regarded emergency physician at Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto. He's also the host of the CBC's award-winning radio show, White Coat Black Art. And he has a TED Talk. How many of you have seen it? He's a million views now, called Doctors Make Mistakes. Can we talk about that?
I'm sorry, I need to.
I just can't sniffle through this whole thing. I might, anyway. He's the author of best-selling book, The Night Shift, Real Life in the ER, which sounds very interesting, and The Secret Language of Doctors. And they're both, by the way, available. His books are available after the service at the kiosk. And his latest book, The Power of Kindness, in that book he leaves the comfort of his familiar surroundings of the hospital, he says, in search of his own lost compassion. I want to share with you our experience of him. In the fall, there were several suggestions for what book we should study, and so, you know, we looked at them, and this book was by far the choice. And we were really excited. We finally made a decision and then discovered it was only available in hardcover. And we try to only do soft cover to make it financially feasible for everybody to join us. So I went on his website, and I filled in the contact form. And I just threw it out there. It's a long shot. And I expected to hear from one of his people, right, saying basically, you know, thank you for your interest, but he's a very busy man, right? And instead, within, I think, a few hours, I got an email saying, so nice to hear from you, and thank you for your interest in my book. And it was signed Brian, not Dr. Goldman, right? So that was my first, okay. And he put me in touch with the contact at HarperCollins, and so we were able to get his book at a discount. So then Ken reached out and agreed to speak to us this morning, and he's agreed. I'm going to leave the room next time you sing if I have to speak afterwards. So I want you all to know that he has agreed to waive his speaking fee to be with us this morning. Yes, yes. And I want you to know, just in case you're wondering what I'm doing, I had people writing saying, oh my gosh, I'm not able to be there, oh no. And so I wrote and said, I know this is probably, not possible, but people really want it. And so he's agreed to let me record his talk this morning, which is also lovely. Yes. So I wanted you to know that about him. I want you to know that over the last few weeks, since we started the study, people in this community have been sharing in the sharing time about the impact that your book has already been having on them. And also, for some people, they've been sharing their experience of you as a physician in an emergency room when they were in a difficult situation, and how kind and how gentle and what a presence that you were for them in those difficult moments. So you have already made an impact on our community, but we are looking forward this morning to learning more from you and getting a sense of who you are in person and what lessons that we can take from this place into our lives about being kind and having more empathy in the world that desperately needs it. So please help me welcome Dr. Brian Goldman.
Thank you, Deb, for that fabulous introduction. You know, I was so expecting that I was going to feel in a place of such as this, you know, very much as a pork chop in a synagogue. So first of all, you're not exactly a church. And second, Deb, what you just did was you were verklempt. Do you understand? That's the Yiddish word. You were verklempt. So I feel totally. So yes, of course that doesn't happen. But you would be so at home in a synagogue by your ability to be verklempt in the moment. That's what we call it. So verklempt. That's the Yiddish word I'm going to tell you about today. I also want to say to Gene and I have a lot in common. You weren't prepared for the duty, and I wasn't prepared for the love and sense of community and just the warmth, not of my personal welcome, but towards each other. It's just such a beautiful thing. And I could walk out of the room right now or better still, I could sit here as I just did for the last hour or so and learn about kindness and empathy. So we are kindred spirits today, but I don't come to you as somebody who's an expert in kindness and empathy. I came at it the hard way. I do want to say one thing about what the lovely excerpt that Gene chose to read about my beloved Tamara, who is this week having a very significant birthday, which I'm telling tales. It's a very important one, and yes, it does have a zero at the end of it. And I had a hard time for a while figuring out what I was going to give her as a gift. And if I can remember at the end, please remind me. I'll tell you what that gift is. Because it's kind of an unusual gift, and it's a surprise to her. So remind me at the end, the reason I wanted to mention Tamara is that she has worked right here in Scarborough, in West Hill, at the YWCA as an employment counselor. And so that excerpt that you read was from her work. She's been at the YWCA Metropolitan Toronto, but right here at LEAP in Scarborough, has helped many, many women re-enter the job market with great kindness and empathy, and right here, almost steps from here. So it was a really lovely coincidence that's the excerpt that you chose, and I have such a strong connection to here through my beloved Tamara. As I said, I don't come at this as an expert in empathy and kindness. In fact, my journey to write that book began with a very unpleasant story for me, but more important for a family. This is the story of a woman who was brought to my emergency department many years ago in the end stages of a degenerative disease. At that point in her life, she was unable to speak for herself. And she arrived with a doting family, a partner, a husband, and adult children, their partners and grandchildren, quite a large family. And they had taken a lot of good care of her over the years, and like many, many families, had reached a point where they were both uncertain as to the physical care she required, had the feeling, the inkling that she was in a pre-terminal phase, and she was entering a terminal phase of her life. And like many other families, they were emotionally overwrought. They were burdened by the transition, for this is a difficult time where you want to give to that loved one, but at the same time, you are worried that you're not the right person to give that care. It was at a time when community care access, when home care, it's not great today, it wasn't as good back then, and palliative care, same thing. And they candidly admitted she didn't need to be admitted to hospital for medical reasons, but they were at their wits' end, and so they brought her to the emergency department, not unlike other families, where the family was seen and greeted by an emergency physician who was very experienced. And this emergency physician, no fool, not the kind of person who, like some emergency physicians, kind of put their hands on their hips and say, no, I will not do that. He referred her to the internal medicine service. And it took hours for the internal medicine team to see her because she wasn't acutely ill. And they have this thing called triage, which in French means to sort. And so it's not first come, first served. If a more urgent patient arrives, they go to the top of the queue. And she was not in respiratory distress. She didn't have a fever. She wasn't dehydrated. She was well cared for. Hours went by, minutes and then hours. And every time the emergency physician walked by, he was asked a question. When will my mother get a bed? Answer, I don't know. Can you estimate when my mother will get a bed? When she sees the internal medicine team. When will she see the internal medicine team? I don't know. Can you estimate when she will see the internal medicine team? And, you know, it's the mentors of medicine say that a wise physician knows how to say, I don't know, to the answer to a question they don't know. What the books don't teach is how to answer, I don't know, 17 times in a row. And so getting a little tight in the collar, at one point in those walkabouts, the daughter of the woman asked the emergency physician, did you actually make the referral? Cocking her eye with a Spockian eyebrow. And the emergency physician did something very uncharacteristic. He snapped at her. I did what you asked, he said, and walked away. And very defensively, which is part of the culture of medicine at times, when people in medicine are put on the spot. And, you know, more time went by. She was eventually admitted to hospital. She was seen by the internal medicine team, and unfortunately, but not unexpectedly, she passed away about 6 weeks later. And then, a few months after that, the emergency physician received a letter, a beautifully handwritten letter, inviting him to come to a meeting with the rest of the family, with the survivors, the husband, and the adult children, in order to learn about this patient, this woman that he did not know in her lifetime. She could not speak for herself at the time. And also, quite pointedly, to see if there was any residual kindness lurking under all that brusqueness that was shown by the emergency physician. Well, I'm not telling tales about somebody else. That was me. That was me. And you know, I understand myself. I accept myself. But at the time, that's what I was. Wound up tight, very anxious, didn't like being asked questions I didn't know the answer to. In my mind, I imagined that there was some other wiser physician who would furnish beautiful answers to all the things that I couldn't answer. And powerless to snap my fingers and make things happen. And that's often the plight that emergency physicians find themselves in. I did go to that meeting. And they talked about what a wonderful woman my patient was. Partner, mother, grandmother, pillar of the community, worker. All the things that I would like to have known about in her lifetime while she was my patient. They cried, and I cried. And it was a very cathartic meeting, and the husband and I became friends. But I have to admit that even then, after all of that, I still did not really understand what it was like to be that family or that woman at that time. That didn't come until many years later, when it was my father's turn. And my father passed away at the age of 92 in 2013, so coming up on 6 years right now. And my father, I knew that for 15 years, the best job he had ever done in his life was his post-retirement job of looking after my mother as she went through her time with Alzheimer's disease, dementia. Some people don't like to call it a journey, and that's why I'm reluctant to call it that. Some people call it a hijacking. I think that's maybe a fairer way of putting it. My dad, I knew, was my mother's social convener and her exercise coach and her nutritionist, and eventually he became her personal care aide. Until one day she developed shingles in her neck and stopped swallowing because it was too painful to swallow. And finally she was admitted to hospital, and my dad was presented with the logic of the situation. He could preside over her death, or he could have her transferred to a long-term care facility. And he chose the latter. It broke his heart. And 6 months later he had his first actual heart attack. And like many, I think it's been estimated that there are about 2.5 to 3 million Canadians, probably a lot of you, who are unpaid or informal caregivers to someone. I've heard some stories already, and you know, we all reach the point when we're caring for someone we love, and if they paid us a personal support worker's wage for doing those duties that we do out of love or a sense of obligation or a sense of duty or whatever, guilt, I don't know, shame, whatever. The cost or the price, the addition to the economy would be something approaching $25 to $30 billion per year across the country. Pretty amazing. Thank you. Thank you to all of you. When was the last time you were thanked for doing that act of kindness and empathy? And so my dad had done that, and he suffered a series of terrible losses over the 2.5 years from his first heart attack and congestive heart failure until his death. The loss of his house, the loss of his ability to drive a car, the loss of his partner, although he visited her twice a day and then once a day, and the loss of his sense of purpose and agency, and so many terrible things that happened to him. Then finally came the last day of his life, and that was October the 19th. You know, he died on the early hours of the 20th, but to me the last day of his life was the 19th. And he had chest pain, and I always knew as a physician, he was, from the moment he was diagnosed with advanced coronary artery disease, he'd neglected his health, like a lot of other people do when they are caring for a loved one. He had advanced coronary artery disease. He was considered too high risk both for a coronary bypass and for an angioplasty, because it would take too much dye to visualize the blockages, and that would have damaged his kidneys that were already damaged by diabetes. And so I always knew that he was about a thimble-sized clot in a coronary artery from passing away. I wasn't thinking very well on the last day of his life, because I'd done a night shift the night before. and I had finished the night shift, had a difficult conversation with somebody over something that I talk about in the book a lot, the shame that I feel over something. I don't know if you've reached that point yet. I don't want to give it away quite yet. He didn't want to go to the emergency department. We persuaded him. An ambulance was summoned, and he was brought to the emergency department, a different hospital from my own, where he rallied briefly. His chest pain seemed a bit better, then started to get worse again. And I remember that a few hours after he was admitted, clerked into the hospital, brought up to the cardiology floor, he waved us all home, started blowing kisses at Tamara. And I remember, at this point I'd been up for 40 hours and I was exhausted. And I took two steps towards the door and impulsively I went back to my father's bedside. I must have had an ominous feeling. And I bent over, kissed him on the cheek and said, "I love you," for the first and only time in our lives. Now my dad, it's not that he didn't love. His love was in duty, not in I love you. And he just wasn't a member of that. He was of a certain age and a certain generation where people didn't say, "I love you." They said, they did it. And I remember going home. I don't remember my head hitting the pillow, but I do remember Tamara's stricken face. It took about 5 minutes to wake me up. Brian, until finally my eyes opened and I saw her face and I just said, "He's gone, isn't he?" And I went back to the hospital. My sister and I, at that point, and we saw this, we were looking at our father. He had just passed away. And he had a look, almost a hint of a smile on his face. And he as if he had seen something. Maybe he saw a white light. Maybe he saw his mother. He dreamt about seeing his mother a couple of months before he died. Who had died many, many decades ago. He cheated us out of the experience of watching him die. And I suspect that if he were here, he would say, "I didn't want them to see me die." And he was gone. And we were, my sister and I were getting used to this new reality. And in walked the attending physician who had been a resident of mine years ago. And I'd met him before. We had conversations about the goals of care. And he had the look of abject terror on his face. What is Goldman going to do? Is he going to start barking? What drugs did you order? What consults did you get? Did you do this? Did you consider that? Why? And he started speaking, mumbling these weird sentence fragments. His heart rate went down, talking about my dad. His blood pressure went down. "We tried to reach you." And it's true. And, our phone wasn't turned on. It was such a weird situation that I was prepared, and obviously I had an inkling, but unprepared at the same time. My sister actually had to bang on the door to wake us all up, to let us know that our father had passed away. She had missed it too. And at that moment, I was kind of preoccupied with being a grieving son, not with being the grilling colleague. And I found myself saying the words, "Thank you very much for looking after my dad," because I wanted to do two things. I wanted to assuage him of his fear and terror. And I also wanted to dismiss him, because if he wasn't going to give me a hug, say, "This must be a really tough time, this must totally suck," anything, or just be there silently, put a hand on my shoulder, then I wanted him to just, go on his way, not with malice, just with, I was overwhelmed, and I didn't have it in me at that time to be in two places at once. I was focusing. I was just getting used to being a grieving son. And in the months that followed, I won't fib to you and say that that's the moment. But as I reflected on that, that's the first time in my life that I really, really, really understood what it was like to be that other family, to empathize with them. And I had already begun to get many inklings. I knew what it was like to be a 50 or 60 or 70 something son or daughter at the bedside of a parent at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I knew that because both my mother and father had been admitted to hospital many, many times. Both were avid consumers of modern health care, warts and all. And so I learned, I already had empathy at that point for people who were who were, you know, at the bedside and had to live with the medical uncertainty. If that first family had been told, you will wait precisely 17 hours, 48 minutes, and 25 seconds, they'd have been okay with that. They would have rolled with that. They would have been there in shifts. They would have done their thing. And at the precise moment, the internist would have arrived. But it was the uncertainty that drove them crazy. And that's what drives people crazy about waiting in the emergency department. And I know that. I get it because I went through it. That's what set me on the search for empathy. And I know I don't have a lot of time, and I know you've read the book, but there's some things I want to emphasize about empathy. Empathy in healthcare, because there does seem to be a lack of empathy in healthcare. And it's not, and when I say empathy, I'm not talking about feeling what the other person feels. There's a lovely book called Against Empathy by Paul Bloom, you may have heard of it, where he makes the case against empathy, but I think it's a bit of a straw man. He's assuming that the component of empathy we're talking about is feeling what another person feels. And he says that that would be kind of paralyzing if you're trying to help somebody because you may be motivated by wanting to get rid of their pain when in fact they have to go through pain to get to the next phase of their life. I may be referring to spiritual or emotional pain at that moment. And so I think he's setting up a bit of a straw man when he makes that argument. We don't want healthcare professionals to be emotionally overwhelmed in the same way that their patients are because they won't be of much use to them. And I think that the orthopedic surgeon who feels deep in her bones the pain, the postoperative pain, the frustration, the sense of dread. Can I do this challenge of rehab to get back on my feet following double knee transplant surgery? She'd probably quit that day if she felt that. So we don't want that. In fact, Helen Weiss, who's not in my book, who is a noted neuroscientist, was on Alan Alda's program, Clear and Vivid. He was a guest on our show. He wrote a lovely book that you should also read. Next book should be If I Understood You, Would I Have This Look on My Face, which is a lovely, and I had a great interview with him. Well, she told him that emotional empathy to a service provider is emotional quicksand. You get stuck in it and you can't get out of it. So that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about cognitive empathy, the ability to imagine what it's like to be somebody else and not be willfully blinded by it. So that surgical team that took 9 hours to see the patient might have sent an emissary down saying, we're thinking about you, but we can't go. We know this is driving you crazy. But they, when they arrive and they act as if, now I'm here now, as if there's nothing to explain, I think that's a problem. I also think that not seeing the patient on the gurney in the emergency department in a hallway for 4 days straight, I don't think that's nice. And I think there are reasons why we don't have a lot of cognitive empathy in healthcare these days. I think a lot of people have had that experience. You've also had kind experiences. I've heard some of the kind experiences this morning already. So there are green shoots of kindness, but there is an overwhelming sense that we're not as kind in healthcare as we could be. And the weird thing about that is that we are all hardwired to be kind and empathic. It's in our brain pathways in places like the anterior cingulate cortex and the insula and the amygdala. And we actually are equipped with brain cells that allow us to both be the participant and the observer in an action, in playing the piano, in tasting something lovely, in tasting something awful, in smelling something bad, in fear, and in sickness. And so the neuroscientists who have studied these neurons, and I talk about them in the book called Mirror Neurons, say that these are the seed of empathy. These allow us to not only be the one experiencing something, but to observe, be in the position of the person who's experiencing it as an observer, not feeling it ourselves. So we're hardwired for empathy, and if you think about it, it makes sense. You know, when we're born, the first thing our mothers do is make goo-goo eyes at us, and we make goo-goo eyes back even before we recognize that that's a face that's facing us. And eventually, we mimic each other's hand gestures and vocalizations and words and then songs, and that's called synchrony. And synchrony is mediated by, at birth, in the mom, by something called oxytocin, which is the kindness chemical. And the oxytocin prepares the womb to give birth, prepares the breast to give milk, and prepares mom to be really thrilled and happy to be looking after her baby. And in fact, there are studies that are looking at oxytocin nasal spray. It's been called the kindness chemical. Spray up your nose might help psychopaths become kinder people. Don't know if it works. I do know that you can buy it on the internet. So it must be there, and it must be effective, because I believe everything that people tell me on the internet. So we have, and synchrony, this is the basis of attachment between parents and their children. It's the basis of a relationship between two people who click. It's the basis of a good relationship, working relationship between client and therapist. So we have this hard wiring, and it's fantastic. And why do we have it? Because it's pro-social. Because you don't build congregations like this without it. You don't build countries that do good. We'd have killed each other years ago, eons ago. We would have just slaughtered each other, and we haven't. So that's on the good side. But we have this other part of our heritage, part of our hardwiring, and it's this uncanny ability at a very primitive level to separate the world into us and them. In fact, the psychologists tell us in a nanosecond, we look at photos and we decide, your kind or my kind? And that's in a deep structure in the brain. It's an almond-shaped nucleus of brain tissue called the amygdala. And it lights up, and it's automatic, and we can't stop it, except that we have this thing called executive function. We have these giant frontal lobes that allow us to weigh evidence and to plan and to have second thoughts and to curb our most basic impulses. That's the good news. The bad news is when a society is under stress, when individuals are under stress, the executive function is cacked, if I can put it that way. And so you resort to your more primitive instincts. If you want to have an example, I don't invite you to, but if you must know whether Goldman's right, I invite you to get into your cars tomorrow morning at about 7:30 or 8 a.m. and drive to downtown Toronto. If you make it, you will discover that you are the only us, other than the people, your loved ones who you're talking to on the phone. Honey, you won't believe this. What's going on here? You'll think that all the other drivers around you are them, and they're out to get you. Okay, and, you know, there are always exceptions. So we have these, we have these two drives, and yet we have this executive function. And you know, why do people resort to us and them? We resort to us and them because we're under stress, and the stress might be emotional, it might be physical, it might be economic, precarious employment, precarious housing, precarious relationships, many precariousnesses, if I can call them that. And I think right now in the United States, you're witnessing the rise of meanness that comes. It's really the rise of us and them, and it comes from a society under stress. And the answer to that, and so for that, I'm not going to blame Trump, except that I think he's exploiting it. I think others like him are exploiting that. And the answer to this is not to get rid of Trump, because that doesn't get rid of the problem, but to answer the stresses of American society today. If you do that, then I think you're on the road to bringing back that executive function that allows the generosity of Americans, which is also very, very well known, the taking in, the Statue of Liberty, and the taking in all comers, all new arrivals to take hold. What's interesting about healthcare is that there are many, many people who do the us and them thing. You'd be surprised. I wrote a book there. I got three copies there called The Secret Language of Doctors, which is basically an examination of the culture of modern medicine as told by the slang that we use. For instance, cowboys are surgeons, and internists are fleas, and we have words like noctor, which is a nurse practitioner who thinks he or she is a doctor, and we have midwives who are, this is a midwife who thinks he or she is an obstetrician, and it's all about us and them. It's sometimes it's nurses and physicians, and sometimes it's internists and anesthesiologists, and sometimes it's healthcare workers and patients and families. So the fact that we divide the world into us and them that frequently tells you that we must be under a lot of stress. And so there are many reasons why empathy is in short supply, but just to name a few, I think technology, time pressure is another one. I think that there's a lot of something that is called moral distress in healthcare, where we know what we want to do, our hearts, our ethics, our mores tell us what to do, but we can't do it in that moment because of time constraints or because of rules or regulations, or it's just not done, it's just not the culture, it's not the convention to do that. And we suffer because moral distress is a risk factor for burnout, and so is compassion fatigue, which is also known as secondary traumatic stress, which is what happens when you bear witness to other people's pain and suffering, which, depending on the job, you do it frequently in the halls of the hospital in medicine. So I cut my colleagues a lot of slack, and I went out into the world to find my own empathy or lack of empathy. Where was it? Why did I become that snappy doctor? Was I still a kind soul? And I examined my brain, and I had an MRI of my brain, and I discovered that in fact, I tend, like a lot of other health professionals in mid-career, to not appreciate the faces of people in pain. And that may, that's a new finding. I'm not unique. I'm not alone. Some of the reasons may be that when I look at the face of somebody in pain, I'm comparing them to 10,000 other people I've seen. Or maybe it's because I know we have this thing called an opioid crisis, and if I say they have 10 out of 10 pain, then am I obliged morally to give them an opioid analgesic? But everybody's telling us I'm a bad doctor if I give opioids, so maybe I assuage my moral distress by underestimating their pain. I mean, it's complex, and there may be reasons for that. I also had my personality assessed, and I discovered that while I am warm-hearted, I am at the 15th percentile for cold-heartedness. I'm at the 86th percentile for Machiavellian egocentricity. Which apparently makes me a very effective emergency physician. And not a bad interviewer on the CBC. But it also means that I have this dark side of me that has a tendency to put my own needs ahead of others. And I'm reminded that at the highest levels of executive function, empathy is a choice. My needs versus your needs. My family's needs versus your family's needs. And nobody ever gets it completely right. And to be completely altruistic all the time may be to sacrifice your family. So there are trade-offs, and you're never going to get it perfectly correct. But I have to tell you that the day that I got the news that I was not a Machiavellian personality disorder, but that I had Machiavellian traits, I felt ashamed. And I'm going to let you in on a secret about me. I am a shame-prone person. I'm the kind of person you can shamey-whamey pretty easily. And I call it shamey-whamey because I'm trying to cut it down to size. Because shame is different from guilt. You know, there are times when shame used to be used to keep the community together and to shun people who didn't follow the mores of the community. And so it was for cohesiveness and for the survival of the community. But it has morphed into the Brené Brown definition of shame to mean that it's the feeling you have when you feel utterly unworthy of love and acceptance. And it's very different from guilt. Guilt is, I did bad. It is positive, constructive. It makes you want to apologize. It makes you want to make amends. It makes you want to pay reparations, and it makes you want to pay it forward by learning from your mistake. Shame is, I am bad. And it makes you wish that a hole would open up in the earth and swallow you up. And you live in secrecy. You don't want other people to know about what you're feeling. And you don't want people to know you made the mistake, because you know it will result in being shunned. The good news about shame is that there's a cure. And that's what I'm doing right now. Talking about my worst, one of the worst times when I was told that I was an unkind person, or talking about my worst mistakes, as I mentioned that TED talk that I did, that's how you deprive shame of the power to silence you and to make other people uncomfortable by normalizing talking about your mistakes. And that was, to me, my fix. That was my big one. So I was actually on, by the time I wrote the book, I was actually on the road to being able to deal, you know, answer the question, am I a kind soul? I've learned the power of apology. I've learned the power of forgiving myself. And you know, some of the things that I've learned how to do on the job, and I'm trying to teach this to my colleagues as I wrap up now, some of the things that I teach, especially my colleagues, because I think we need it. And I want to say one thing about that, meanness and unkindness, that we think that we're bestowing it on the other person without any effect on us. And that's wrong. If you are unkind to somebody in the moment, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up, you're in distress, and it's eating at you, and it's contributing little by little by little to burnout. The opposite's true. When you're kind in the moment to somebody, then your blood pressure goes down, and your heart rate goes down, and your well-being goes up, and it's the most infinitely renewable resource that we have on the planet. So what do? How do you unlock your own power of kindness? You breathe. I tend to exist either in the regretful past or the worried future. Can't live there. Can't live in the past. Can't live in the future. You can only live in the moment, but it's like a muscle. So how do you anchor yourself to the present in any way you can? One way that I do it is to breathe, box breathing, breathe in to a count of six. Tony Robbins taught me this. Hold your breath to a count of six. Let your breath out slowly, evenly to a count of six. Do it three times, he said, you feel better. And he was right. And if you get bored with six, make it seven, make it eight, make it 20, whatever it is, and you can do it. And so you can, it's hard to worry about the past or regret the past or worry about the future when you're breathing, you know, when you're concentrating on your breathing. I do whatever mindfulness I can do, whether it's meditation, because I have this unique ability to latch on to negative thoughts. Singular ability to take other people's kind of nasty looks or whatever and turn them into something that I'm really focusing on. I turn them into ugly floats in a parade. So I now imagine that I'm now in the reviewing stand of a parade and whatever it was, you know, face of cardiologist who will never forgive me for the patient from hell that I referred them, you know, 20 years ago. Look from nurse who thinks I'm incompetent in the resuscitation room. And the thing about ugly floats is that, like floats in a parade, they go by. You don't run onto the back of the ugliest float and build a house and say, I'm going to live here and I want to dwell here. And so that's how I deal with that. I practice self-forgiveness, self-compassion, and there are times in the middle of the night when I'll say, Brian, I forgive you. Because if I don't forgive me, who will? And I look for things that I find in common with other people. I practice gratitude. I write long lists of the things that I am grateful for. And you know what? If I get excessively worried, then I'm going through a phase of my life when I'm doing that, I just write down, I give myself worry time. I prescribe worry time for myself. So what I do is I just, during that worry time, you know, 4 p.m., whatever, 10 a.m., whatever, for the next 15 minutes, I write all the things I'm worried about. And you get exhausted after a few minutes. It's just gone. So that is what I have discovered. That's what I'm sharing with you, not as somebody who's an expert in this, but as somebody who's discovered himself. And as I said, I think you've got it. Just use it. Thank you for letting me share my thoughts with you, and thank you for bringing me into your fantastic community. And I did say that I was going to tell you what I'm giving my partner to Mary. You know, you never know what to give people for significant birthdays. And you know, if you've ever thought, I don't know what restaurant or I don't know what, you know, what to give, you know, a piece of jewelry, she's got plenty. A spa. Yeah, a spa is not a bad idea. Clothing, Brian, don't buy clothing for me. Don't buy clothing for me, Brian. Don't do that. I am giving her the gift of our daughter. Our daughter, Kaylee, is right now, this weekend she's in Barcelona. She is studying at Ulster University in Northern Ireland. She's doing a winter term. This is a total surprise. Don't say a word. I'm flying her back for 48 hours on her birthday.
Lovely. How nice.
The look on her face. No, I'm not getting a camera out because you don't photograph moments, you live in moments. right? Anyway, that's what I'm doing for her, but don't tell her. Okay? Thank you.
Okay. Don't go anywhere.
Don't post this until Thursday morning.
Okay. Excellent.
Thank you. Could you grab one of those chairs? Maybe two. I'd like us to just sit down here and chat for a couple hours.
Oh.
I'm kidding. I'm actually kidding.
Of course.
But honestly, that whole von Economo neurons and stuff and empathy, it's all, I studied all that when I was writing my last book. This is from John DePetty, who is a member of our congregation. And he began making things from the supports of our pews when we were taking pews out. Because generations of people have been supported in this place by what they do. And so this is just a set of coasters. You can pawn them off on Tamara if you want. But I also want to, just here, these are for Tamara. Every longest night service, we give out these candlewick bracelets. And we say to one another, as people come up to the front, we say this scripture passage, which everybody knows that Jesus said, I am the light of the world, but few people remember that he said, you are the light of the world. And so we give these bracelets out, and we say, you are the light of the world. And so I want you to have that and squish that on your hand.
Yep.
Okay. And I want you to take these three for the next people you see in your emergency room. And then if you could take this one for your daughter to take back to... school, because North, Ireland,
Well, and, especially with Brexit.
Yeah. And
they're terrified.
And if you could give, if you could give these to Tamara for the people that she works with, we'd really appreciate it.
Okay, we'll do that.
So thank you so much for being here. Oh, here, a couple more. There you go. Good. Please stand. What a gift we have been given today. To be able to come into this place, which, as I say, has held so many people so long, through their joys and their sorrows, their challenges, their losses. I was thinking, as you spoke, of Harold Bennett, Donna Lockhart's dad, who was like this man who was so kind, and he had horrible arthritis, but he cared for his wife through dementia, getting up in the middle of the night to drive her around the block because she said she needed to go home. And he grew raspberries in his garden, and he shared, and he was the most beautiful guy. And when he was unwell, he was on a gurney in the hallway, and he became, something that no one knew and no one cared for and no one loved. And the things that he could have told them were legion, but they just passed him by. So I am so moved that you are calling that system to account, that we who have these mirror neurons are being challenged to look in one another's eyes and see not another person but ourselves, so that we can treat one another differently. We can go from this place out into that world that challenges us every day to dig a little deeper. And we'll be able to do it with courage and with love. So thank you. Go from this place in peace. Can you join?
Be filled with loving kindness. May we be well, may we be filled with loving kindness. May we be well, may we be peaceful and at ease.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.